That's how things were, one long adventure, the bounty of a young boy's life. In letters to my grandparents, I would faithfully record many of these events, confident that more civilizing packages of chocolate and peanut butter would surely follow. But not everything made its way into my letters. Some things I found too difficult to explain. I didn't tell Toot and Gramps about the face of the man who had come to our door one day, with a gaping hole where his nose should have been, the whistling sound he made as he asked my mother for food. Nor did I mention the time that one of my friends told me in the middle of recess that his baby brother had died the night before, of an evil spirit brought in by the wind. The terror that had danced in my friend's eyes for the briefest of moments before he let out a strange laugh and punched my arm and broke into a breathless run. There was the empty look on the face of the farmers the year the rains never came, the stoop in their shoulders as they wandered barefoot through their barren, cracked fields, bending over every so often to crumble earth between their fingers. And their desperation the following year, when the rains lasted for over a month, swelling the rivers and fields until the streets gushed with water and swept as high as my waist, and families scrambled to rescue their goats and their hens, even as chunks of their huts washed away. The world was violent, I was learning, unpredictable, and often cruel. My grandparents knew nothing about such a world, I decided. There was no point in disturbing them with questions they couldn't answer. Sometimes, when my mother came home from work, I would tell her things I had seen or heard, and she would stroke my forehead, listening intently, trying her best to explain what she could. I always appreciated the attention. Her voice, the touch of her hand, defined all that was secure. But her knowledge of floods and exorcisms and cockfights left much to be desired. Everything was as new to her as it was to me, and I would leave such conversations feeling that my questions had only given her unnecessary cause for concern. So it was to Lolo that I turned for guidance and instruction. He didn't talk much, but he was easy to be with. With his family and friends, he introduced me as his son, but he never pressed things beyond matter-of-fact advice or pretended that our relationship was more than it was. I appreciated this distance. It implied a manly trust. And his knowledge of the world seemed inexhaustible. Not just how to change a flat tire or open in chess. He knew more elusive things, ways of managing the emotions I felt, ways to explain fate's constant mysteries. Like how to deal with beggars. They seemed to be everywhere, a gallery of ills, men, women, children in tattered clothing matted with dirt, some without arms, others without feet, victims of scurvy or polio or leprosy, walking on their hands or rolling down the crowded sidewalks in jerry-built carts, their legs twisted behind them like contortionists. At first, I watched my mother give over her money to anyone who stopped at our door or stretched out an arm as we passed on the streets. Later, when it became clear that the tide of pain was endless, she gave more selectively, learning to calibrate the levels of misery. Lolo thought her moral calculations endearing but silly, and whenever he caught me following her example with the few coins in my possession, he would raise his eyebrows and take me aside. "How much money do you have?" he would ask. I'd empty my pocket. 30 rupiah? How many beggars are there on the street? I tried to imagine the number that had come by the house in the last week. "You see," he said, once it was clear I'd lost count, "better to save your money and make sure you don't end up on the street yourself." He was the same way about servants. They were mostly young villagers, newly arrived in the city, often working for families not much better off than themselves, sending money to their people back in the country or saving enough to start their own businesses. If they had ambition, Lolo was willing to help them get their start, and he would generally tolerate their personal idiosyncrasies. For over a year, he employed a good-natured young man who liked to dress up as a woman on weekends. Lolo loved the man's cooking. But he would fire the servants without compunction if they were clumsy or forgetful or otherwise cost him money, and he would be baffled when either my mother or I tried to protect them from his judgment. "Your mother has a soft heart," Lolo would tell me one day after my mother tried to take the blame for knocking a radio off the dresser. "That's a good thing in a woman. But you will be a man someday, and a man needs to have more sense." It had nothing to do with good or bad, he explained, like or dislike. It was a matter of taking life on its own terms.